The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Mrs. Razi Cecik now presents her lecture, From Gutenberg to Google, A Brief History of Talmudic Transmission.
Many years ago, in one of my favorite high school literature classes, I read a short story of a young mother with two small sons and a college professor husband who shared her dreams of traveling the world. Each day when he returned home from work, they would pore over atlases and travelogues, planning this much-longed-for journey. One day, the young professor stood before his class, reciting Samuel Taylor Coleridge's famous poem, Kubla Khan. And he began, in Xanadu, did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree. And when he reached the final couplet, down to a sunless sea, he collapsed, leaving his young wife a widow. And in her torment and in her grief, she packed up herself and her two small sons, sold their modest home, and with the proceeds embarked on a sort of tragic, inverse, mirror image version of this journey that she had hoped to take with her husband, sweeping through the world with her somewhat puzzled young sons in tow, visiting all the places that she had hoped to visit together with him, and perhaps hoping to find him in the shadows of these unfulfilled dreams. And I thought of this story several years ago when I traveled back to Europe after the passing of my very beloved grandmother, Edith Grunebaum, to visit the vistas of her child in Austria and Hungary, towns and cities to which none of her descendants had returned since the deportation of her family to Auschwitz in the summer of 1944. And the trip had its humorous moments. I hired a tour guide whose website assured me he spoke multiple languages, among them English. But when he picked me up in Vienna at the airport and we drove through the porous borders of the European Union, and I asked him questions like, are we in Austria now or the Czech Republic? And he would turn around and nod and smile and say, yes. So that the only way I knew we were actually traversing these porous borders were the friendly text messages I kept getting from Verizon. You are now in the Czech Republic. Calls to the States are $2.30 a minute. But despite the language barrier, we did ultimately manage to reach the town where my grandmother had lived. And my heart started to pound as I reached the address that I had found on a ghetto deportation listing. And when I approached the building, there was a sign on the outdoor saying that it was landmarked from the 1800s, so I knew it was the actual building that my grandmother lived in. It had been converted into a multi-family dwelling, so I pressed, this is a typical Manhattan, I sort of pressed a few buttons, hoping someone would let me in. And ultimately, when the ubiquitous, wherever you are in the world, pizza delivery man showed up, I followed him into the building. And I obviously wasn't able to enter any of the apartments, but I sat in the common areas, the stairwell, the cellar. I went out into the back garden. I said some Tehillim. I prayed. I cried. And I, too, felt a strong connection to my grandmother in these vistas of her past. And there were really two gifts that emerged for me from this journey. One was a sense of reconnection to this woman who was so central to my life. And the other was in the archival, in the rich digital, newly digitized archival material of Yad Vashem and Jewish Gen Online. In addition to finding data about my grandmother, I stumbled across another poem written in Yiddish in the archives of Yad Vashem that told the story of a different widow, Devorah Rum, the woman whose story we are going to tell today. In the year 1860, Devorah was 29 years old. Her husband David was 35. They had five children together, as well as two children of his from his first marriage. His first wife had passed away. David travels to St. Petersburg in the summer of 1860 to buy ink and paper for his family press, when he too suddenly collapses of a heart attack. But unlike the protagonist in our original story, instead of collapsing in her torment and her grief, Devorah galvanizes, gets up, and takes the highly unusual step, particularly in the somewhat patriarchal society of 19th century Russia, and takes over her husband's printing press, and in doing so, transforms the landscape of Torah scholarship. Has anyone here ever studied from a Mikros Gedolos, Mikraot Gedolot Chumash, with its compendium of medieval and modern commentaries on the page, that chumash was the design of Devorah Ram. Before it went to print, she got a letter from her cousin, the Netziv in Volozhin, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, saying, I understand you're about to print a chumash with a compendium of commentaries. Can you please include the Svarnu? He's not studied enough, which is how the Svarnu made his way onto the page of the Mikraot Gedolot Chumash. But of the dozens and then hundreds of volumes ultimately produced by the Rum Press, the magnum opus was the Vilna Shas, the canonical edition of the Talmud that is studied in every Beit Midrash and every yeshiva throughout the world today. And how it was that this young woman came to print this Talmud and how her story is so unknown is what we are going to look at today through a journey of sort of Talmudic transmission. And we'll begin, I'll ask your permission to step back with me some 3,330 some years to the revelation at Sinai, Matan Torah on Har Sinai, when God's voice echoed amidst the thunder and the splendor. According to rabbinic tradition, either right before Matan Torah or immediately after, Moshe Rabbeinu wrote down from the first words, Bereshit Bara, until Parshat Yitro, until the story of Matan Torah. And the rest of the Torah was given to Moshe Rabbeinu at intervals throughout the desert. And the Gemara in Masachet Gitin, Daf Samach, Amud Aleph, records a machloket as to how these words were written down. Amar Rav Yochanan, Torah Megillah Megillah Nitna. Amar Reish Lakish, Torah Chatuma Nitna. Rav Yochanan says the Torah was given scroll by scroll. Reish Lakish says the Torah was given sealed. And Rashi explains this to mean that according to Rav Yochanan, Moshe, every time Hashem appeared to him, he wrote down the words that Hashem told him. Ubisof Chayav, in the words of Rashi, at the end of his life, Chibran Begidin Vitafran, he bound them together into one larger scroll. And according to Reish Lakish, Shamar Ba'alpeh, he sort of memorized all the words Hashem told him, and at the end of his life, wrote it all down in a single scroll. And the Talmud reserves harsh words for anyone who denies the divine authenticity and Mosaic transmission of even a single word or phrase in the Torah. And in Masachat Sanhedrin, cites a proof text from Tehillim, Alav Ne'emar, if anyone denies the divinity and Mosaic transmission, Ki Dvar Hashem Baza, Umitzvato Hafer, Hikaret Tikaret, harsh words that I will not translate. The only machloket or controversy that exists in the rabbinic literature regarding the authorship of the Bible, of the Chumash, is on the last eight psukim describing Moshe's death. Did Moshe write these words describing his own death? And in a beautiful elegiac phrasing in Masachet Baba Batra, Daf Yudalet Amud Aleph, the Gemara says, O Moshe Kitavan, O Yehoshua Kitavan, either Joshua wrote these last eight psukim describing his teacher's death, O Moshe Kitavan Bedema, or Moshe wrote them, right, with tears streaming down his face, such like evocative imagery. Along with the written Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu, according to Jewish tradition, received an oral tradition as well, what we refer to as Torah Sheva Alpeh. And I'm completely not going to do this justice due to our condensed time frame, but filtered through the prism of the Maimonidean understanding of Torah Sheva Alpeh, Moshe received data from God in these 40 days after Matan Torah. He received information, and he received what's referred to as Midot Shehatorah Nidreshet Bahem, hermeneutical principles through which data could be extracted from the biblical text. This was meant to be an oral, living, evolving transmission, not fixed to the static nature of a page, conveyed from teacher to student in a Masorah. And so it was until the year 189, approximately, according to the medieval work Sefer Seder HaKabbalah, when the Jewish people were about to head into exile, and their leader, Rav Yehuda HaNasi, was afraid that this oral tradition would be forgotten. And the Gemara records how he stood up and said, again, citing a proof text from Tehillim, Et lasot l'Hashem heferu Torah-techa. There's a time to do for God, even when it means abrogating his will. And thus, thus the dynamic, ever-evolving, vibrant Torah Shebaalpeh became confined to the static word of the page. Now, how is this physically transmitted in an era before the printing press? And if you have the booklets that were distributed, there are more of them here, on what you have is page 2. This is actually a rare extant copy of a single page. And if you open up and look at what you have as page 2 in your booklets, right, this is a page that scholars date to Spain in the 13th century based on the script, right? Is there anything you notice about this page that looks interesting to you and different from what you'd be accustomed to seeing a Talmudic page? So remember, in the ancient world, text was very expensive and very precious, right? It was written on either sheepskin, goatskin, parchment, or vellum, and etched by a scribe, handwritten. So the idea of a single person owning a set of Talmud was unheard of. You had countries and regions that didn't have an entire set of Talmud. It is said that Rabbeinu Gershom Ma'or HaGola, one of the earliest Ashkenazic sages in the 10th century, did not write commentary on the tractate Avodah Zarah because he didn't have access to that text in the entirety of the Franco-German region, right? So this page is a page that was probably the entire library of its author. It belonged to a Spanish Jew. It seems he took it with him when he fled Spain and brought it to Italy. If you look on the side, I don't know if you could see this faintly in the photocopy, there are some notes. Those are his notes on his library that he took with him during the Spanish expulsion. Now, how do we have this page, this rare, beautiful page, which was printed on vellum? In Italy, and we'll talk about this in a few moments, during one of the Talmudic burnings in the 1500s, the pages of Talmud were gathered and they were burnt in the morning. And at night, Christian bookbinders would come steal these pages because they were such good quality to use them in the inner bindings of other works. And in the past 100 years, dozens of these pages have been found throughout Italy as like binding in registers and town census documents from the Middle Ages, and they are referred to as the Italian Geniza, which is how this individual page of unknown provenance made its way to us, right? When Rashi, as a young man, traveled from Troyes to the great academies of Worms and Mainz in Germany to study from the students of Rabbeinu Gershom Ma'or HaGola, he did what every young man did in the pre-printing press era. He took with him two sort of notebooks of parchment. With one, he copied out the tractate being studied. With the other, he took the notes from his rabbis that he learned in Mainz and in Worms. And he also edited and aggregated the rest of that information, and he copied it into his notebooks and brought it back to France, which is why Rashi's commentary is referred to as kuntres, which means notebook, when the Tosafot referred to Rashi's commentary. Right? So pages were extremely, extremely precious. And such was what a page of Talmud looked like until the 15th century. And if you turn in your booklets to page 3, and this is a page that would look more familiar to you. This is one of the earliest printed editions of the Talmudic page. The transmission of knowledge underwent like a seismic and almost unfathomable shift in the 1450s with the invention of the printing press. Does anyone know who invented the printing press? So the canonical knowledge is that it's Johann Gutenberg, and we're going to go with that. But there are different theories that there was an earlier Chinese version, and there are some conspiracy theorists that it was actually a Jew, but a Jew couldn't invent in that time, according to the guild, so it was given over to Johann Gutenberg. But we'll take the standard understanding. Johann Gutenberg, in the 1400s, was the son of the master of the mint in Mainz, Germany. So he grew up working with metal and coins. And legend has it that one Sunday afternoon, he went walking out in the fields around Mainz and came across a vineyard where he saw a wine press in action. And he looked at the wine press and he thought, what if we took our skill with metal? We made little letters in boxes. We put them on lines. We put them in this press, right? And then something that would take a scribe days or weeks or months to prepare could be prepared in a matter of moments. right? So an absolute revolution in the transformation of knowledge, where it used to be if you wanted to study a page of Talmud with Rashi and Tosafot, you needed to own a handwritten expensive scroll of Talmud. You had to own a scroll of Rashi. You had to own a scroll of Tosafot. You had to align them, completely inaccessible, but to the wealthiest or the greatest scholars. And now the study of Torah is open to all. What do you think was the reaction of the rabbis and of the Catholic Church to this completely radical new invention that totally democratized the nature of knowledge? You did not need to be wealthy or powerful to transmit or access information and text. Anyone want to guess? The Catholic Church was totally against it, right? The democratization of knowledge is an anathema to the nature of the Catholic Church. To quote the papal bullum, this is the work of the devil. I would also say that you had thousands of monks living in monasteries throughout Europe. They prayed five times daily, and the rest of the time they spent in the scriptorium copying over text. So the monks' union probably wasn't too thrilled with the invention of the printing press either. The rabbis, however, totally jumped on the bandwagon of the printing press. We are Am HaSefer, people of the book, and now knowledge and text and Torah study and prayer works could be open and accessible to all. And a fascinating bit of data is that in the 1450s to 1500, what's referred to academically as the period of the incunabula, from the Latin word cune, meaning cradle, right at the beginning, Jews constituted less than 2% of the European population, more than 25% of the books printed were Hebrew books. The earliest dated Hebrew printed book is around 1480 in Reggio di Calabria, Italy, and it is a book of Rashi on the Torah, but not the text of the Chumash itself, just Rashi. They hadn't yet figured out the idea of combining them onto one page. And the earliest Talmudic tractates also begin being printed during this time. And as people are figuring out book culture, the early books didn't have page numbers, right? Like, oh, it took like 5 years to think we should have pagination for uniformity. And the earliest dated tractates of Talmud that we have were printed in Italy by a family known eponymously after the town they came from, the Sancino family. I used to pronounce this Sancino. I gave a lecture to a group of Italian Jews. One of them came over after. He said, "Very nice lecture, but the entire time you keep saying Sancino. It's Sancino, Sancino, Sancino." So he traumatized me, and now I always pronounce it correctly. The Sancino family were originally a German Jewish family, descendants of the Tosafist Simcha of Speyer from Germany. They fled Germany during the Rindfleisch massacres, landed up in Sancino, Italy. They opened up a money lending business. And 2 years later, the town of Sancino opened up a bank called a Monte di Pietà. So they went into this early printing and they designed the Talmudic page as we know it with this brilliant idea of what academics call text and paratext, meaning you have a canon text in the middle of the page of the Talmud, which is like 1,000 years of rabbinic tradition, surrounded by another 500 years of conversation by putting Rashi and Tosafot on the same page, right? This was their idea and their design. They also innovated the idea of having beautiful borders. If you look at the word shamai, you see how it looks like a beautiful decorative border. These borders were extremely expensive, so they were often purchased secondhand from non-Jewish printers. And there are some funny little, sometimes you see imagery. One of the earliest printings of Masechet Beitzah has little bunnies and winged angels that are not classically Jewish imagery because they bought them from these Christian book printers, and some of them were purchased from the original printing of Aesop's Fables. And if you look in the older editions of the Talmud, you could see them aligned in these decorative borders, right? But the brilliance was really that they took the Talmud and added another 500 to 1,000 years of conversation to the page by adding Rashi and Tosafot. They decided to use another font of printing, which is famously known as Rashi's font. It is the bane of every Jewish school child today, trying to learn those letters. It was not Rashi's handwriting. It was their attempt to have two different fonts on the page. The Sancino family printed several several tractates of Talmud, and they were closed down in the early 1500s, probably by order of the church, and the art of Jewish printing moved to Venice, which was like the Silicon Valley of Jewish text at the time, of printing at the time. And the story is told that the first complete printing of Talmud, this is not a story, I'll tell you the story in a moment, the first complete printing of Talmud was in the early 1500s, printed by a man named Daniel Bamberg, who came from Flanders, from Belgium, from a merchant family. His name was Daniel von Bambergen, and he shortened to Daniel Bamberg. And he landed up printing the first, editio printemps, the first entire Talmud, based off the original tractates of the Sanchino Press. And because he did so much work, if you look at the Daf Yomi today, the 2,711 pages, that's the Bamberg pagination. It came from the Bamberg Press. People assumed that he was Jewish in subsequent generations because he did so much for Jewish scholarships that I've actually seen this Catholic referred to as Harav Daniel Bamberg Zecher Tzadik Levracha in later texts. The legend is that when Daniel Bamberg arrived in Venice, his goal was to open up a Latin printing press, and he encountered a former Jew, a Jewish apostate to Christianity, named Felis de Prato, or Felis Praxis. Now, it was very hard to be a Jew in the 1500s, and people often converted out for practical reasons of oppression, but still really loved Judaism and Jewish text, and Felis de Prato was one of these people. And I imagine Bamberg getting off his gondola in Venice, looking around, meeting Felis de Prato, and Felis telling him in Italian, in the equivalent of, I'm telling you, Daniel, the money's in Hebrew printing. So instead of opening up an Italian printing press, Daniel opens up this Hebrew printing press, first edition of Talmud Yerushalmi, first edition of Talmud Bavli, the earliest version of a Mikraot Gedolo Chumash, which only had Rashi and Ibn Ezra in it, the idea of, again, text and paratext. And these precious, beautiful volumes that he printed, many were destroyed in later burnings, but there is seven extant or eight extant copies in the world of the first Bamberg Talmud. One of them, which was owned by the Valmadonna Trust, we have in our audience a son-in-law of the Lunzer family, went for auction about 2016 in Sotheby's, and I went down just to look at this beautiful, it was like leather binding and gold tooling, and you just opened up, you could see all the thought and the love that was put into this printing. It went that Sunday for over $9 million, which was just above my book buying budget that weekend, and was purchased by someone who is not in Jewish education or communal service, but in finance, and I hope he is taking very, very good care of that very, very precious text. If you turn to the next page, so the words of the Talmud, or you could stay there actually for a little bit, but the words of the Talmud, right, this text of the Talmud was now being printed all over the world. In 1553, just after these texts are initially completed, there is a papal decree in Rome and in Venice and in all of the papal states to burn every single page of the Talmud that is found anywhere throughout the papal states. This actually had less to do with the Jewish community than what was going on with the Reformation of the church, but the decree was an incredibly painful one in the right around this time of year in Elul 1553. And the law was that every single page of Talmud, every volume, every page, had to be brought to the authorities. There was a house-to-house search done between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur in 1553. If a page of Talmud was found in a Jew's possession, for that page, he was decreed to have 2 years in prison. And if there was a second violation, 5 years in prison. And cartloads of Talmud were gathered in Campo di Fiori in Rome and in the Piazza San Marco in Venice, and they were set on fire. And there was Jewish memoirist, an unpublished memoirist written by Matityahu Delacrat, who witnessed these burnings. And he writes, and I'm translating from the Hebrew, Our books are lost, the little that we had, for not the Pope and his cardinals in Rome have decreed to trample our books and our glory, trample and burn them in fire. And here today in Venice, more than 1,000 volumes of Talmud have been burnt, and over 500 editions of the Alfasi, beloved pages, new and old. You hear the mourning in his words. I'm going to contrast this with the papal bullum, again, from the papal nuncio in Venice the same day. And this is his diary entry. He wrote, "It made a good fire." That was the papal entry in Venice that day of the papal nuncio, the papal representative in Venice. But the words of Talmud had flown, and they were being reprinted in Krakow and in Lemberg and in Constantinople. Now, remember that for hundreds of years, the pages of Talmud had been copied over by hand. So there is scribal error that is going to enter the Talmud. And some of the original printings were based on this scribal error. There are 2.2 million words in the Talmud spread out over, you know, dozens of tractates, 2,711 pages. And there are errors that crept into the text. And you had rabbinic sages who dedicated great effort to finding and eradicating these errors. Because otherwise you'd have someone studying Talmud and saying, it says A here, and it says B there. Let me try to reconcile it with C when B was really just a typo. One of the rabbis that did this was the Bach, Rav Yoel Sirkis. And one of the rabbis that did this, and I want to talk about him for just 2 or 3 minutes in Vilna before we arrive at the Rum Press, was the Vilna Gaon, Eliyahu of Vilna, who lived from 1727 to 1797. He was such a prodigious genius that when in Hebrew, when we refer to the Gaon, without saying who we're referring to, it is the Vilna Gaon. It is said of him that by the age of 4, he had memorized, and I read this written by his children, so it's not a, you know, hagiographic biography written a century later, that at the age of 4, he had memorized the entire Tanakh, and by the age was started to study Talmud, and by the age of 6, he had outgrown all of the rabbis of his hometown. So his parents sent him at the age of 6 off to study with Rav Moshe Margoliot in the town of Kedanai, which is like an hour's drive south of Vilna. And when I went on this trip to Vilna, I traveled to Kedanai, and the shul where they studied is still there. And it's at the edge of town, and there's like a beautiful cobblestone square outside. And I picture, you know, I was looking at the sun spilling through the windows and lighting up the square, and there were children playing hopscotch and jump rope, and thinking, did the Vilna Gaon play? Right, like, what was he like, this young genius of a child? By the age of 12, he had outgrown any rabbis and became an autodidact. His sons write about him that he learned for 22 out of 24 hours a day, do not try this at home, and slept only for 2 hours in 15-minute increments, keeping his feet in a bucket of water so that he would stay awake. And they write that when his sister came to visit him, not having seen him for many years, he spent a few minutes with her, and then he said, you know, I can see you in Olam Haba, but only in this world can I learn, don't try this at home either with any of your siblings, but only in this world can I learn Torah. And the Vilna Gaon stayed in his cloys or his room learning day and night. I actually found the room where he lived, and it's today owned by a Lithuanian family. They're living there. They were watching television and frying meat, and I felt like knocking on the door and saying, you need to get out of this house, this holy, holy place that, you know, so much Torah was generated. It belongs to Am Yisrael. I did not do that. But the Vilna Gaon only left his cloys that we know of meaningfully twice in his life. Once, he bade farewell to his family, and he told them he was heading off to the land of Israel, to Eretz Yisrael. And he wrote an ethical will. He didn't have many material possessions, but he had a lot to give over in terms of values. He wrote an ethical will. There were two fascinating points. One, that this great Torah sage wrote to his children, "For all of the Torah you learn, the most important thing is to be good to other people." And the other thing he wrote is he asked his wife and mother to get along, which shows that even in the best families, there could be tension in that relationship. So the Vilna Gaon leaves Vilna, but instead of heading east to the ports and to Eretz Yisrael, he lands up heading west toward the great university libraries, particularly like of Hamburg and of Munich. He comes back to Vilna After a period of a couple of months, he tells his family the time was not yet right, and he never speaks about it again. And Professor Ari Morgenstern of Bar-Ilan University theorizes that he looked at these ancient Kabbalistic manuscripts. He wanted to sort of force the Mashiach. And he looked at these Kabbalistic manuscripts, and he saw that it wasn't the right time. So he came back home. The other time that the Vilna Gaon left his klais, he left for a three-year journey that's called in Yiddish a praven gullus, or a private exile. And he traveled through Europe, sleeping like anonymously for humility on, you know, benches in Batei Midrash and in shuls, and also looking at every extant copy of Talmud that existed throughout Europe. He comes back to Vilna, and he filters the student of the Vilna Gaon, Rav Chaim of Volozhin, who is not prone to exaggeration, wrote of his master, the Vilna Gaon, that the Gaon knew by heart the entire Bavli, the entire Yerushalmi, the Tosefta, the Zohar, and the entire Midrashei Rabbah, right? Almost the entire corpus of rabbinic literature. So the Vilna Gaon, with his prodigious genius, his incredible knowledge, and now having looked at all of these texts, comes back and makes approximately 50 emendations, or changes in the text of the Talmud based on that combination of his knowledge and logic and wisdom and what he learned. But even with all that he had cognitively and this text that he had seen, he knew he was tampering with the Holy of Holies, and it said that he would fast for 3 days and go to the mikvah before making even a single change. Those changes landed up being folded into, if you now turn to page four in your booklets. This is the only example we have of the handwriting of the Vilna Gaon. Fascinating story of how it was acquired by this Matike Hashmoa Institute, but it's a if you look on the left side of the page, it's a page from the Talmud Yerushalmi, Seder Zra'im, printed in Amsterdam in 1710. And on the side, on the left, that is actually the handwriting of the Vilna Gaon. So if anyone's interested in graphology, there might be quite some things to discover from that little bit of text. And now we arrive in Vilna, the home of our heroine, on page 5, Devorah Rum. So how do I know? If you look at this page 5, right, this it says Brachot Min Talmud Bavli, big red letters Vilna, and underneath Bidfus V'Hotzaat Ha'almana V'Achim Ram, right, printed by the widow and brothers Ram. So how do we know Devorah's story? At the end of every single set of Talmud, every single Vilna Shas, the final volume, Masechet Nidah, there was a 9-page essay called Acharit Davar, which in translated, it's a pasuk from Kohelet, Tov Acharit Davar Mireshito, better is the end of something than the beginning, but it really means epilogue. And this epilogue tells the incredible story of the printing of the Vilna Shas. And it is so little studied that I've spoken about it to thousands of Jewish people in 50 or 60 communities around the world, and I've asked, has anyone read this text? And only 3 people have ever raised their hands. One of them, one person who told me had read it was Rabbi Willig, that one of the Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University, who is a neighbor of mine in Riverdale who's read everything. The other was someone who had just finished a doctorate in Talmud. And the third person was a rabbi who I was speaking in the shul, and he said, I knew you were going to talk about it, so I read it yesterday. But otherwise, it's a very little-known text, even though everyone has it at home. It's never been printed in translation, though I've done a translation together with my son, and I hope to publish it. And it tells this unbelievable story. And if you look at page 7 in your booklet, well, and if you aren't comfortable with the Hebrew, I will be translating everything we look at. But it begins, Divrei ha'almana v'achim Ram, hamad pisim asher b'Vilna. These are the words of the widow and brothers Ram, the printers in Vilna. Right? The year is 1886. Eliezer ben Yehuda is still starting the enterprise of modern Hebrew and arguing with his wife about whether they're going to speak Hebrew at home. I don't know if you know this story. He said, we're going to speak Hebrew. She said, no, we're not. They didn't talk for 2 weeks. And then they started speaking Hebrew at home. So Hebrew is still a language of learning, right? At literature and learning. So her words sound like, you know, Divrei ha'almana v'achim Ram hamad pisim asher b'Vilna. They sound like the Hebrew of the prophets. Chazon Yishayahu ben Amotz asher chaza al Yehuda v'Yerushalayim. Right? Divrei Yirmiyahu ben Chilkia. It's written in this rich, beautiful Hebrew. And she writes, for all of the years that that the past centuries that Talmud is being printed, it's just reprints of the original ones, and we decided to go ahead and print a Talmud with a perfected, amended text, perfected versions of Rashi and Tosafot, and adding over 100 commentaries that were never added before. And we paid no attention, the Hebrew words, Einenu lo chasa al hakasef. We paid no attention to the cost. We did whatever needed to be done to print this most important and significant of Jewish texts. And if you look at page 7 on the left side of the page, there should be two highlighted phrases. This is one of my favorite descriptions. She describes how they arrive in the Vatican Library in the summer of 1881, and they have hundreds of copyists waiting and dozens of editors and thousands of orders, and they get to the Vatican Library where the only existent text of Rabbeinu Hananel, Tamasechet Avodah Zarah, an important sage, resides in the Vatican archives. And she writes, V'hine sh'arei ha'otzar ha'hu nin alul arba v'chatzi yirachim. The Vatican Library, which had a great union, is closed for 4 months every year. Miketz chodesh yuni yisager, she writes, at the end of June they close. Umeitzchilat November yipatach, and they only open again at the beginning of November. And she writes how this, you know, v'navola, if you look at the highlighted, right, v'navola hatiklanu et perushola masachet eruvin v'sharei masachtaot, we wanted to print this, asher b'romi, these texts that were in Rome, b'veit akad hasfarim, in the library shebevatikan, and later on the page, in the next highlighted segment, she writes, "Ulam kelma uzenu shalach lanu Moshiach." But God sent us a savior in the name of Natanata Rabinowitz, author of Dikduke Sofrim. He was the only person in the summer of 1881 who had access to the Vatican Library. And she writes, he was kind enough to lend us his copyist, and we were able to access the text that we need. Remember again, there were no copy machines, so if you wanted something copied, you had to have an expert copyist. She writes, there was only one in Rome that summer because the library was closed. His name was Rav Kapu from Corfu, and Natanata Rabinowitz allowed us to use his copy. I once saw a very cute cartoon. It showed a sleeping monk, you know, in the full garb, and it said, "Darn, the copy machine is down again." Because that was a... So this copyist was able to assist them. Now, something I only discovered 2 years ago, I've been researching this for many years, is why the Vatican altogether had opened up their archives to Jewish people and opened up what was called the secret archives altogether. And if you look at what you have as page 8, on the bottom there's a footnote, and there are two names. I don't know if they're highlighted. They're a little hard to read, but she lists by name the cardinals, Henlehau and Hergenrother, who allowed them access to the Vatican archives. Why is the Vatican, which for years stole texts from Jews, destroyed texts, allowing Jews into their archives? And what I'd like to posit, and this is something I came across in, like, this idea in my research, and I sort of verified it with one of the scholars in the Vatican archives. The year 1856, I don't know if anyone has heard of the Edgardo Mortara kidnapping. There was recently a movie made about it. There was a young Italian boy. He belonged to a wealthy Jewish family in Bologna, Italy. The family had a beautiful mansion and servants, and the Italian Jews were relatively, like, assimilated Orthodox Jews, right, but very much part of Italian society. His family hired a Catholic nanny to care for him when he was a baby. He became very ill when he was about 6 months old, and the nanny was afraid that he would die. And she loved him, and she didn't want him to go to hell, where all the other Jewish babies went, according to her worldview. So she secretly baptizes him. Edgardo gets better, he goes to school, the age of 5, the nanny leaves the family, and she starts feeling this guilt because, according to papal law, these are the papal states, a Catholic child cannot be raised by a Jewish family, and technically, this is a Catholic child. She reports it to her confessor, it goes all the way up to the Pope. In the summer of, it was around 1856, there's a knock on the door of the Mortara family. It is the papal police. They come and they kidnap this child and they bring him to the Vatican. The mother is crying. The father is threatening to call counsel. The American ambassador protests. The French ambassador protests. Edgardo is kept by the church. There is a long court case. His parents are ultimately granted visitation, one day a year, supervised visitation. Edgardo becomes a priest. priest. He lives as a priest. He moves to Belgium. He dies as a priest. And there are books written on the Mortara kidnapping. And there was a film this summer in Italian at the Cannes Film Festival about it. It is said that the Mortara kidnapping and the world reaction to it actually led to the fall of the Papal States. And it is in this climate that the Vatican decides to open up the archives and demonstrate their kinds of openness to the Jewish people. And that is when Devorah and her colleagues arrive there. Because of time, I will just tell you this story very quickly. She goes ahead and on page 8 describes, we're in the middle of printing this press. And on the top she writes, we're doing our work. And there was an anan kaved al hahar, choshech, anan va'arafel, a great cloud, and sa'arot, storms. She is referring here to the assassination of Tsar Alexander II in the year 1881. It was a cataclysm for Russian Jewry. He was the reformist Tsar, giving Jews rights the way Jews had in Western Europe. When he was assassinated, there was one Jew involved in the plot, in the entirety of the plot, and there were anti-Semitic riots throughout Russia, particularly in the Ukraine, so these are referred to as Sa'arot Teiman. Russian Jewry was devastated, right, for all that they had achieved. Their lives are now collapsing under the weight of these riots and this return to oppression. That is when, between 1881 and 1914, 2 million Jews leave Russia to come to America. The Bund is born, the Zionist movement is born. Jews realize they can no longer stay in Russia. And she writes, in 1881, we thought to stop. Aval kel ma'ozenu, we heard God's voice telling us, do not cease climbing the mountain and printing the works of my holy Torah. And she ends at the end, I'm doing this very quickly because of time, at the end of page 11, she thanks by name everyone who helped with this project, including Professor Neubauer from the Bodleian Library in Oxford, and Rabbi Kohut from New York City, and all the different archives and the rabbis who helped them. And she ends with the words, v'nisayim bevracha v'tehila lakel ma'uzenu. I end this is the bottom of page 11, you know, with praise and thanks to God, v'nivarchenu b'mea brachot v'alfei tehilot, with 100 blessings and 1,000 praises. And she says, k'shem shezachinu l'sayem, just as we merited to complete this work of Talmud with emended, perfected texts and 100 commentaries, kach nizkel hatchil shuv, so we should be able to continue to begin to print other works for your name and your glory. So who actually wrote this text? It's signed Almanav HaAchim. There were no Google Docs in those days. My theory, and I will give it to you in 1 minute instead of an hour, is that Devorah herself wrote this text. And there's a line on page 9. You can look for it later. It's highlighted. It's the above what you have highlighted. She writes, she leaves, as I read this text and translate it, I found like a dozen hints where she leaves herself like little hints. Here I am in the text, and maybe one day someone will read it and realize. My favorite one is on page 9. Where she says, Lo haya defus bi Israel, there was no good printing among the Jews, ad shekamti ram, ad shekamti defus bi Israel. Until I, Ram, got up, I, Ram, a mother in Israel. This is a direct paraphrase of the line from Shirat Devorah, the prophetess, right? Ad shekamti Devorah, ad shekamti im bi Israel. So, and her name was Devorah. So one of the many little hints that she wrote this. Now, what ultimately happened to the Ram printing press? Devorah passed away in 1903. Most of her sons by then had fled. The printing press continued to hobble along after her death. In the year 1903, by the way, I found in the New York, there was an American Jewish necrology, like a yearbook, where they listed important people who passed away. And I have the printing where it says, Devorah Rum, printer at Wilno, right? So important that in New York, they were noticing it. All the printing presses in Vilna, according to the archives, were shut down on the day of her death, Jewish and non-Jewish. Thousands of people went to her funeral. She was very recognized for her contributions to Torah at the time. I also found an ad in 1907 in the New York Jewish Chronicle saying descendants of the Rum family seek to open an English language printing press in New York for a translation of the Talmud, but that did not happen. I found her son Gershon in a New York census living on 7th Avenue in New York City, also in the early 1900s, before 1910. The printing press goes into a period of decline. In World War I, in 1914, we know that the employees of the press moved into the building because it was one of the most secure buildings in Vilna, so they could survive the, you know, the aerial bombings in Vilna. The Lubavitcher Rebbe at the time, I believe it was the Rebbe Rashab, when it went into decline, convinced Baron Gunzburg, a wealthy philanthropist, to give the press the funds it needed to continue because of all it had done for the Jewish people. In 1940, the Soviets march into Vilna. They shut down the Rum Press. They shut down the Streshen Library, started by Dvorah's maternal uncle, Matatyahu Streshen. And then in 1941, the Nazis march into Vilna. And they start gathering the Jews into the large ghetto and the small ghetto and sending them off by the dozens and then the hundreds and then the thousands to the killing fields in Ponar, in Ponari. And a young group of Jews in the ghetto, right, Vilna, the city of scholars and poets and artists and dreamers, get up to fight against the Nazis. And you can look at the videotaped testimony of Abba Kovner, one of them, at the Eichmann trial, where he sits at that stand in Jerusalem and he recalls, Amarti Achai, lo nelech katzon latavach. My brothers and sisters, let us not go like sheep to the slaughter. And the poets and artists and scholars and dreamers of Vilna rebel against the Nazis. And in the dark of night, one of them who survived the war, his name was Avram Satzkever. He was a famous poet. He lived in, made his way to Eretz Yisrael after the war, died in Tel Aviv in 2010. He writes a poem about what happened one night in the darkened ghetto of Vilna under Nazi occupation. How they broke through the windows and of the, I'm sorry, they snuck out through the gates of the ghetto, reached the Rum Press, broke through the windows, took the metal plates that had been used to print the Talmud and melted them to make bullets to fight the Nazis. And he writes a poem, I'll translate from the Yiddish, it's called The Molten Letters of the Rum Press. Like thieves through the night, we crept through the darkened streets of Vilna. Dreamers forced to become warriors, we took the letters that once kept us alive in spirit to now keep us alive in flesh. And I felt like the high priest at the altar, melting one line from Babylon and one line from Krakow to save the Jewish people. Anyone who saw the brave young men of the ghetto saw Jerusalem strapped across their chests, saw Am Yisrael rising and fighting for life. We opened up with a picture of a text, right, a handwritten text from the 13th century. We moved ahead and looked at a page from the Italian Bamberg printing press. We looked at a page of the Vilna Gaon's emendations. We looked at a cover page from the 19th century of the Vilna Shas. And if you open up your booklets to page 6, and with this we'll close, we have now what is one of the most modern iterations of Talmud. We have Safaria and we have edaf.com. While you used to have to be wealthy or powerful to own a text of Talmud, now any Jew at any point can access any page of Talmud on their phone at any time. And the text that I chose to share with you today is a famous paragraph from Masechet Avodah Zarah, Daf Yudchet Amud Aleph, and it's the story of Rav Hanan ben Tirajon, one of the 10 martyrs. We just read it on Tisha B'Av, we read it again on Yom Kippur. And the story, as you see it here, you know, when the Romans came, they wrapped him up in a Torah scroll, right? They put cotton on his chest to delay this process, and they lit the Torah scroll on fire. And his students said to him, Rebbe, our master, what do you see? And he said, the parchment is burning, but the letters are floating in the air. And I use this as our concluding text because for me, it's the ultimate mirror image text of Satzkever's poem, right? That metal plates can be melted and parchment can be burnt, but the pages of, and the letters and the words of Torah are eternal and they transcend above fire and we bring them down together anytime we learn Torah as we do sitting together here today. Thank you for listening.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.